Okay, so we're here for Radio Warnerd installment number 4. This is Mark Ames, and I'm here with Gary Brecher, a.k.a. The Warnerd, a.k.a. John Dolan. John, are you there?
I'm here. I'm here in Albania at 5:30 in the morning.
Oh, my God. It's 3. Okay, so we got our times a little bit off. Okay, so you're in Albania. Are you in duress? Where are you?
Yeah, I'm in duress on the beach, and the nights in Albania are really weird. I mean, there are these giant packs of dogs that rule the city after dark. If you'll remember from Moscow, you know, the dogs take over as soon as the sun goes down. But in Moscow, they're not very loud dogs, but in duress, they want you to know that they're on the street. And there's a garbage depot opposite our building. You can smell it when the wind is right. And the dogs consider that garbage depot a treasure trove. So there are big bark fights all night between different packs of dogs.
I do remember the Moscow dogs because I got attacked by them and had to, the doctor wanted me to consider getting rabies shots. And if you remember, Crazy Kevin got attacked pretty badly, I think, by those dogs.
Yeah. I remember some cops chased you down because you were running from the dogs. And when you explained what had happened, they said, "You want us to go back and shoot them?"
I didn't even remember that. That's funny. Yeah. Well, and I think I told them no. It was strange. I think, and that was 1999. So it was just after the crisis hit, the first crisis, you know. It was so bad that even the street dogs were starving. So they were literally like attacking humans in Moscow, in the center of Moscow. I mean, a lot of friends. And then things got a little better again. And they stuck to taking handouts and I don't know.
Yeah. Eating times cat. Were good.
Times were good again. When the oil price rose, you know, it was good for the street dogs. So
those dogs follow the financial news. I mean, can catch them reading Commerçant in the metro.
Yeah, damn capitalists. So I hope this is going to sound good enough. We're in strange situation. I'm in an empty apartment recording this, which may be why I do sound like the Wizard of Oz. Somebody was complaining in our last podcast that my voice was too quiet. I'm looking at the levels now, and I am dominating. I think this in the red. This is like turned up to 11. It's probably full of feedback, but whatever. Anyway, so let's get into the world of war. But before we do that, I wanted to thank, we have another $100 pledge that just came in from Carlo. And which reminds me to all of our pledgers, we need to reach out again to our, 4-star general Subutai fellows. There's 3 of them now who've pledged $100, and find out exactly how they'd like to be known as sponsors of the show, and then we'll sort of, you know, reward you and call you out in a much bigger way, exactly how you want it the next show. Am I right, John?
Yeah. I want to mention some feedback from listeners too, and actually, that question about how you want to be mentioned is important because I don't know my level of disreputability at the moment, but it's been fairly high at times in the past, and you may not want to be associated by your real name with anything to do with me or Mark or this program.
I have a great reputation, stellar.
Sorry, you're Mark Wall of Sound Ames, but me, I'm not so sure about.
Yeah, okay, so that's why I'm just using the first names and why we did the last time. I mean, and we'll reach out to you. We've got some emails somewhere. We're just, you know, we're not the most tech-savvy guys. We come from a different era, more simple era.
Liberal arts, all the way.
Yeah, that's right. A failure out of chemical engineering right here. So, yeah. So let's, I actually copied down a few of the, we actually had a lot of very interesting reader comments and feedback and so on.
Yeah.
I want to get to that later because one of the comments and feedbacks that I got from one of our earlier shows was put reader comments at the end, get to the wars, which, and then do that at the end. So moving on to wars. First of all, military news in the last week or since we had the last Warnerd podcast show. I guess the first big obvious thing is migration and war, and you know, the refugees in Europe and the war in Syria. Have you been? How are you seeing that from there? You're in the Balkans, so you're sort of in one of the routes.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, and I thought about routes or routes. I mean, it was like apricot or apricot. That was an important question in my neighborhood. But anyway, I'm in the Balkans and I'm not seeing any migrants. I suspect that's because I'm in Albania, and you know, there are times when I listen to the xenophobic stuff ranting about refugees and feel like saying, well, there's a sure cure. Just give away everything you've got and nobody will bother you anymore. Albania is not bothered by refugees. As I haven't seen anyone that I can identify as, you know, coming from Syria or sub-Saharan Africa or North Africa or anything like that. I mean, you can't always tell, obviously, but I don't see a lot of refugees. Albania has offered to accept 75,000 and refugees, you know, 75,000 more than Saudi Arabia has offered to take. But I don't think there are any here simply because Albania is a very poor country, and nobody wants to go from wretched poverty to wretched poverty in a different country, because that's much harder. I mean, you and I have both shifted countries, you know, and I think people who haven't done that don't know how hard it is and how brutally frustrating it is 100 times a day to be the foreigner who can't express themselves properly and looks like an idiot and can never really be eloquent, never really be at ease. It's a very hard thing. And especially when you're looking for a job in a place like that, it's not something you do easily.
Or so comfort, coming, you know, comfort for your children. Yeah. I mean, that's the part that always gets me too. Are these, how do these people travel with their little children? Yeah. I mean, my God. So you want at least some level of comfort after the hell you've been through.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the most basic level, migration and war, if we're honestly going to talk about that, it's a way of killing people. And it's an extremely effective way of killing a tribe that you don't like. The so-called Arab Sudanese from Khartoum and the north, you know, black people who happen to consider themselves Arabs for some weird reason and consider the people south of them to be, quote, black in a pejorative way. When they started massacring southern Sudanese, they were able to get very efficient killing, because when you kill one village with a few hundred people, the news travels extremely quickly. And you send, in some cases, millions of people fleeing, which seems like a sensible decision, but isn't really. Because if you start fleeing in the tropics, through areas with no sanitation, especially through the malarial swamps of South Sudan, you start to die. And not you, really. Your children start to die. The children are the ones who die, and they die in huge numbers. There's a reason the population of South Sudan is only about, you know, 6 or 7 million right now, and that's because a whole generation of children got purposely killed off. Not because they thought they could kill all these people with guns. You don't need to do that. You kill them with guns, or better yet, you kill them in some particularly horrible way. You rip open the bellies of pregnant women and hang them from trees or something like that. And what you do is send millions of people into motion for every person you kill. And then they simply die. You don't even get to be blamed for it. They die by the roadside. They just can't walk anymore. The children usually. And they just lie down and they don't get up. In South Sudan, between around 1982 and 2005, this horrendous war was going on using that method as standard practice. Something like 5 million people were put in motion, and of those, probably 1.5 million died. So that's the traditional method of using migration in war. You
Trail of Tears. I mean, it makes me think of Trail of Tears and basically how the Indians or Native Americans were genocided into submission, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And even in American history, you'll find the Trail of Tears described as a brutal movement that had some unfortunate side effects. But you're awfully trusting if you take those as side effects.
Yeah.
What if that was the purpose? You can't put settled families in motion without expecting them to die, not when everybody's walking.
So is this then Assad's strategy? Is this massive, refugee wave, is that Assad's specific strategy? Or is that, now and how did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, when I mentioned South Sudan, I think my real point is that it dwarfed anything that's happened in Syria, and it dwarfed what's happening in Europe now. And when you're talking about refugees, it matters a whole hell of a lot where you're fleeing from and where you're fleeing to, because the South Sudanese refugees were basically fleeing south and west from a very obscure part of the world that doesn't interest anybody into an even more obscure part of the world that interests people even less, a place where you really can't even go, unless you're taking the kind of malaria prevention that makes you have really interesting nightmares for years to come. So those people fled and died very quietly. What's going on in the movement from Syria to Europe is a very well-publicized but essentially much smaller and much less brutal wartime migration. There have been thousands of deaths, mostly at sea, from drowning victims who got on, what used to be called coffin ships. That was a term from the Irish famine, another sort of quasi premeditated famine. You put them on ships, the ships can't sail, the ships sink, they die. That's a way of dealing with this too, but it's happening on a relatively smaller scale. I mean, and I thought about how I'd mentioned this because I've spent the whole summer around the Balkans, and you'd expect if you're a news consumer in the West that to live in the Balkans right now means nothing but desperate refugees clinging to trains all the time. And you don't actually see that. And I don't think that proves it isn't happening. I think it proves something worth mentioning about what it's like to be in a war zone. It's not like the movies. It's not like action all the time. Most of the time, you don't see anything. You're just people are just going along in their normal way. I saw most obvious, what you might call visible minorities or visible refugees in Greece. Maybe because they'd reached the EU and they were content to stay.
Yeah.
But even in Macedonia, which is supposedly a big route, I was in Bitola near the Greek border for 3 months and. You didn't see a lot of refugees. I mean, who knows? You don't know what's happening. Maybe that there were thousands of refugees passing by in closed trucks every day. But I can't say I actually saw it.
Right.
But what you do see here is a very, I mean, Europe is a very ethnically sensitive deal. These are countries that define the people and the nation in pretty much the same way. And they're fragile places in that way. Mm-hmm. And the arrival of a bunch of immigrants is a huge deal for them. I mean, it's nothing on the scale of Hispanic, Central American, and Mexican migration to the U.S., but for all the noise from the right wing in the U.S., I think the U.S. has handled a much more massive migration with less cultural stress, say, because there's that tradition of bringing in and using cheap labor. Even you can hate it, but you use it.
Yeah, and it's an old tradition, right? And it doesn't seem to be the same tradition in Europe. I mean, that's what they're clearly doing, places like Germany and probably France.
Yeah.
But they don't quite know how to deal with it.
No, there's not the same tradition. I mean, Germany is doing that now. It's doing it in a very cold-blooded, sensible way. I mean, when you've got no birth rate, why not bring in people who are in their prime? people in their 20s and 30s. I mean, I'm not, to put it very, very mildly, I'm not an economist, but it makes a kind of rough sense when you don't have to raise these kids. You just get them when they hit 25 and they're ready for a lifetime of work, and you didn't have to, you know, wipe their noses while they were growing up and see them through the months and all that stuff. They're ready to go to work right now.
Yeah, they're ready to pay into the system rather than just taking from, you know, the system. They're just paying in for the people who are taking out. And from an employer's point of view, I mean, certainly the American employers, their attitude is you can mistreat these people a lot more than you can mistreat the natives. The natives, the local borns know their rights much better and, you know, are more keyed into the, let's say, the labor union system and so on and so forth. And obviously a refugee is going to be a lot more nervous about taking advantage of their rights.
Even in the US you could see
the
sort of half bright right wingers sort of realize that, like, wait a minute, George W. Bush, his friends kind of like cheap, scared labor, don't they?
Yeah.
No wonder they aren't helping me. But you know, what can you do? I mean, that there's so much xenophobic hatred that in some way their party is the vehicle of that hatred, and you can't stop it. So there's a lot of friction going on, but you know, when the friction settles, I think the death rates will be relatively low. As for what's happening in Syria, I mean, especially when you compare them with South Sudan, and that's what keeps hitting me, because every time I do a story about anywhere in the world, I keep having this echo, like, what about Africa? You know, I mean, in parts of Congo, when ethnic war was breaking out, usually with a lot of help from whatever the local mining company was, one of the militias would kill very often women, and especially pregnant women, in some particularly horrific way, and send hundreds of thousands of people flying into the equatorial jungle. And those people are going to die. Mm-hmm. And they did die. It's just nobody noticed. I mean, the people in flight now towards Europe are going from Syria, a place that the world has some kind of focus on, to Europe, a place that the world always focuses on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they're getting an awful lot of attention. But I just want to mention, for the sake of justice, if nothing else, there have been much, much bigger and much more disastrous migrations in everybody's own lifetime that got no attention at all. But as for what it's doing to Syria, most likely it will reduce further the numbers of the anomalous communities, that is the Alawites, the Christians, a few of the Druze.
Kurds.
The Kurds are a tricky bit, but these Alawites and Christians on the coast are a small group. And Ayman al-Tamimi, one of the great bloggers of the Syrian war, has suggested that the general estimates for Alawites in Syria are way inflated. They're usually said to be about 10% of the population. And he says, no way. They've been emigrating for generations. And part of the reason that Assad's armies are having so much trouble now is there just aren't that many of them. It's not a matter of casualties. It's a matter of emigration, not just from this generation, but unnoticed immigration from a couple of generations back, because nobody's taken a real census in Syria for the better part of a century. So nobody really knows how many of these minorities there are. But every generation, some of the Alawites, some of the Christians decide it's a scary place. There's this endless pressure from the inland Sunni majority against our coastal enclaves. And we've got friends in, you know, wherever, Toronto or Detroit or somewhere. We're going to go there. What it's most likely to do is change the demographics of Syria in a way that reduces the number of those minorities. But that's something that's been going on for a long time. As for the Kurds, it's really hard to know whether, I mean, there are some claims that the people who are called Turks in Germany, for example, the big Turkish minority there are overwhelmingly Kurdish, which might explain why there's been such a relatively small contribution from the Turkish Kurds to the jihadi efforts.
Mm-hmm.
But the Kurds also have a high birth rate. And, you know, whenever you've got a right-wing xenophobic movement, you get this anxiety about the other group's birth rate. Mm-hmm. So Turks, who used to have a fairly high birth rate by European standards, are terrified on the right wing about the Kurdish birth rate. You hear this over and over again when you go on these crazed comment sites, and part of my job is going on comment sites because I don't just listen to the sane people, or as we call it, the sane minority. I listen to the totally insane, vicious majority as well. And one common place you get on that is, Turks only have 2 children per family. Kurds have 4 children per family. So a lot of the anxiety from Erdogan's voters in the AKP and on the Turkish right is that they're going to be swamped with Kurds.
That's pretty ominous, if that's really bubbling over, because unlike, I mean, you hear that in a lot of, you know, a lot of fascist grumbling in a lot of places that are pretty inactive volcanoes, but Turkey's not inactive. So that's pretty ominous.
It's a very old thing. I mean, the French 20th century right wing is like birth rate. And it's even happening in the US now, which is a really bad sign. I mean, I hate to see it. Church is about out when that starts happening.
Yeah. I got to ask you just one question, slight detour here. I know we're going to get into a bit more of Russia and Syria, but can you clarify for listeners, what's a barrel bomb? What do they mean when they talk about barrel bombs? Because I've been seeing all of a sudden just in the last few weeks, now maybe this has been going on for a while, but like the head of Human Rights Watch and all these outraged people saying, you know, that Assad dropping barrel bombs. I mean, it sounds like, I'm sure it's horrible, but they're making it sound like it's maybe the single greatest crime of any war in, you know, 100 years or something. What's unique about barrel bombs? What the hell?
Oh, the only unique thing is the low tech. I mean, Assad's air force, what's left of it, and there isn't, until the Russian shipments anyway, there wasn't much left of it, was running short on munitions. And one of his warlords, as they're often called in the attack pieces, came up with the idea of just stuffing ordinary oil barrels with explosives, crazy gluing on any scraps of metal you could find on the outside. Because, you know, with a bomb, you don't want just blast, you want flying metal to kill people with.
Right.
And then dropping them on Sunni neighborhoods in places like Aleppo, basically punitive raids in the classic Second World War manner on civilian neighborhoods.
It sounds like improvised cluster bombs, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Yeah. I mean, the advanced countries have cluster bombs, which scatter mini shrapnel bombs over a wide area in a very efficient manner. I mean, you often hear their manufacturers gloating about how many football fields they can cover. A barrel bomb doesn't work as well, but a lot of these neighborhoods are very dense, high-rise places, and I'm not even sure how much the shrapnel really matters. It's, in this case, it probably is the blast, because if you knock down a high rise, you know, you're pretty much going to kill everybody in it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what it's doing. But they're ordinary high explosive bombs dropped from airplanes. The only unusual thing about them is the fact that they're improvised. And this raises an interesting question that was mentioned by one of our listeners who made a fascinating point. In one show, I think it was our last show, I said there's a strange anti-Shia tilt to coverage of Syria, as if all the sectarian massacres committed by the Sunni militias don't quite count as much as this sort of atrocity. And he said, no, what about the barrel bombs? They don't get much attention either. Right. Of course, you're saying now that they are starting to get attention, which suggests that there's an agenda going
on. I'm seeing it everywhere,
Yeah, but until recently, it's pretty much true that they didn't. And what he was saying is there's a kind of double standard here. If you're seen as a helpless savage fighting other savages, then you get a huge break and nobody much cares what you do. But if you're associated with the higher, richer world of the West, like the Kurds have been, then you're going to get held to a much higher standards.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true. I mean, I do see a lot of, well, haven't the Kurds been ethnic cleansing? Like, well, first of all, there's no proof that they have been ethnic cleansing. And second, you're basically, if they were, you're talking about a misdemeanor in a world where you basically got to have a few murders on your sheet before you get any respect at all. So there is a question anyway of, yeah, why certain atrocities get attention at a given moment in the Syrian war, because it's a war of pretty much nothing but atrocities. I've said for like more than a decade, most war consists of massacre and counter-massacre, not battle. And that's certainly been true for Syria. So I think the focus on the barrel bombs now most likely is tied with the sort of rejuvenation of Assad's military through these Russian shipments, because what I've been seeing is huge propaganda offensive against the Russian military shipments to the SAA, Assad's army. I mean, using Assad as a metonymy for the Alawite Iran-backed regime of the coast. I mean, we talked about this last time, right? That Michael Weiss story, like Russia puts boots on the ground in Syria, the one that talked about how the end of summer means back to school shopping and Russian adventurism.
Yeah. That was funny.
But that was only like the opening salvo. Now there's been a barrage of stories, particularly in the Daily Beast, for reasons about Russia and the horror of Russian arms shipments. I mean, it's clear Russia has been shipping arms to Assad's army. But I found something really interesting in trying to research those arms shipments. In Michael Weiss's story, for example, and in most of the Daily Beast story, you get photos and descriptions of offensive infantry weapons. Like, he talks about the BTR 82, which is a newer, better Russian armored personnel carrier that's being brought in. But when I started researching what the Syrians have actually been buying from Russia, what their priorities are, something very strange happened. I thought I was just getting it wrong at first, and then it started to make sense. They're not mainly buying infantry weapons with which to fight the Sunni militias to the east. What they want overwhelmingly is anti-aircraft weapons. And at first, I couldn't figure that out at all. Like, Islamic State doesn't have an air force. I mean, there was one little joke story where they talked about, we've captured 3 airplanes and now we're going to have an air force. Yeah, okay, good. Get some pilots.
And don't burn them this time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
It's tough, you know, just to not burn them, but, you know, try.
It's true. It's not that hard to turn people. If they kept that Jordanian in a room with one really good persuader and one person with big fists, they could have turned him around in a few weeks. But, you know, Islamic State, they're meatheads. They don't think that way. They think, ooh, let's burn him. But anyway, so they don't have an air force. Nobody on the Sunni side has an air force. And yet, I mean, when I looked at this, the shopping list for the Syrian Arab army was extraordinary. I mean, first of all, surface-to-air missiles, probably including the the Russian S-300 surface-to-air missile.
That system and the S-400 even more so have been systems that have always created like panic and hysteria every time Russia's ever talked about selling it to anyone, which I guess means it works.
Right, exactly. That's what it means. It works, and it scares.
And we haven't faced, or we, or basically anybody on our side, has not faced a workable anti-aircraft system since the Vietnam War, as far as I know.
No, and it is reasonable to assume that the USAF and the IDF Air Force, the Israeli Air Force, the two, let's say, stakeholders in this operation, are extremely afraid of that because basically manned fighters are an idea whose time has come and gone, and they're extremely expensive, overloaded, very vulnerable weapons. And the next war, the skies will be filled with drones. And there's a sort of half-conscious admission of that by all the brass of all the air forces of the world. But they don't want to deal with it right now. So
a lot of money on the line. I'm sorry.
Huge amounts of money. Yeah, huge amounts of money. I mean, $1.5 trillion just for the F-35.
Right, which you wrote about the flying Albanian mushroom, as we call it.
Yeah, I had a Pete Townsend moment there. I was going to say, for the F-35. So the Syrians are trying to buy and or have bought the S-300 surface-to-air missile. In fact, there was an Israeli Air Force airstrike on some munitions in Latakia, apparently things that had just been fresh off the boat in January 2014. And there were huge secondary explosions of a kind that makes some people think that was a strike on a shipment of S-300s, because the Israelis are very frightened of casualties in general, and especially of losing warplanes. So in addition to the S-300, which is a long-range surface-to-air missile, the Syrian army has also been trying to buy the Pantsir S-1 short-range air defense missile. And the Pantsir, which means like shell, like a beetle shell, is designed basically to protect S-300 batteries, to protect the radars, to protect the launch unit. So what you've got is kind of like a whole furniture suite here. You know, the S-300 to attack long-range targets. The S-300 can track something taking off 200 kilometers away, like from an airbase within Israel or from an airbase within Turkey, because there are threats from Turkey as well as Israel and from the USA off the coast. So to protect your S-300s from being attacked, you use the Pantsir, which has a combination of missiles and guns to defend that site. But that isn't all. It's incredible, the list of stuff the Syrians have been trying to buy from the Russian armed forces. There's the S-25 Nieva, a long-range, older air defense missile. And this should be a familiar name to anybody who follows the news, the Buk M2.
Mm-hmm. Now, just in case any airliner, any Boeings fly overhead.
If you are attacked by a Dutch airliner, man, you want the Buk in your corner, because those imbecile Cossacks. Now, this is something I honestly don't understand, Mark. Maybe you can explain it to me. The Buk is a very high altitude surface-to-air missile. What would make a Russian liaison officer hand it over to those retarded Cossacks in Donbass?
Money and vodka. I mean, really, and availability is all I can think of. And you know, they had shot down, I seem to remember, some Ukrainian like transport planes and a couple of fighter jets in that area, because the Ukrainians completely own the skies in those battles. And the Russians did their counteroffensive, they brought in some anti-aircraft guns. They started shooting some of these guys down. I'm still just kind of blown away by, I'm willing to entertain a lot of stories and a lot of, arguments on the Russian side in this, but I just can't understand anybody who seriously argues that, that it wasn't the rebels who, the Russian-backed rebels who shot down that Boeing. It's just, but whatever, that's all part of, the propaganda war. But in any event, I don't know. It doesn't, I mean, obviously something bad was going to happen, but, you assume that until you're there in Russia, you assume that they have this like really great line of communication and have complete control over it in the Soviet robotic way, and that Putin is there in his, you know, master control room and everything is approved by him. But, you know, in reality, it just doesn't work that way at all.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, as Rumsfeld might say, you don't go to war with the proxies you want. You go to war with the proxies you have. Mm-hmm. And the available proxies in that part of the world are a really mixed bag, especially when you're dealing with Cossacks. I remember talking to Limonov about Cossacks.
Yes.
I think you told me this story. He was talking to the Cossacks, and all they say is Jews, Jews, yeah. Jews, Jews. And he says, you know, but my Cossack friends, you're surrounded by Islamic warriors, and all you do is talk about Jews. And there's this sort of Beavis and Butthead stare for about half a minute, and then they say, perhaps you, Limonov, yeah, are a Jew.
Yeah, well, what they said was, your name is Edward Veniaminovich, Edward's son, Benjamin. Is this perhaps why you are defending the Zionist conspiracy? And Limonov has never had, I mean, you know, for all of his extreme politics, he's just never had any patience for, like, anti-Semitism and dumb racism and stuff, you know, so... Yeah, he that was it for him. I want to say that I once in Rostov quite literally drank a whole table of Cossacks under the table. I couldn't do it now, but I did then. Yeah, and then told them I was a Jew when they were drunk. It was a deeply humiliating moment for them. So
how did they react?
Just kind of morosely, you know. I
don't know. We have been drunk under the table by a Jew.
It's over. It's over.
But then if you're one of those right-wing nationalist guys, it's always been over, you know? The whole thing is, the birth rate thing, too, is about how it's always been over. And it goes back to some pretty deep-seated anxiety, as one might say. But they're very gloomy people. There's never any possibility of winning. They don't even aim for it. They just aim to go out with a bang. But anyway, so but even that isn't the full shopping list. It's incredible the money they've been putting into this. I mean, so there's a whole suite. I mean, basically, it's like the Pantsir for close-in, short-range. The S-300 for very long-range. The Tor-1, which is like low and medium altitude, NATO codename Gauntlet. The Nieva for medium range also, an older, bigger missile that they can get cheap. So basically you're dealing with a force that is terrified, not of the Sunni militias to the east, not at all, but terrified of being attacked by a first world air force.
Wait. Let me tell you. So how could they not be terrified of the Sunni militias? I mean, granted, based on their shopping list, but how could they not be when, as far as I understand, about half of the 250,000 deaths in the Civil War are fighting age Alawites or at least pro government soldiers. I don't know if that's right. I'm sure it's hard to get any stats, but that's what I keep reading.
Yeah.
So I mean that they're literally running out of people to fight.
Yeah. Stats are very difficult. I've written about that before. I mean, like I said, there's nothing to start from because there hasn't been an accurate census of Syria for almost a century.
Right.
And like any sectarian ethnic war zone, you can't go door to door asking people, what's your ethnicity, sir, madam? Because you'll die. And you'll get lied to even if you don't die. But one possibility is that, as Ayman al-Tamimi has said, there never were that many Alawites in these places. That it's not that they've suffered huge casualties, they just weren't as numerous as they were made out to be in the first place. A lot of the Syrian Arab Army's recruits are actually Sunni, because when we talk about Sunni, it's not a bloc, it's a bunch of people with clan loyalties, tribal loyalties, local neighborhood loyalties, because a lot of this clan tribal stuff is breaking down into proletarian neighborhood stuff, which is a whole different deal.
Right.
So you can always recruit Sunni, even if the people you're fighting define themselves as Sunni. So it's actually very mixed up. But will those Sunni fight for you, or do you have to rely on your Alawite core. That's not really clear. I mean, the other problem there is that the Syrian Arab Army, Assad's army, doesn't just draw on Alawites; it draws on Lebanese Shia from Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is a very big, powerful force. I mean, arguably the best infantry in the Middle East. But Hezbollah is a very smart group. They're not jumping into the Syrian war with both feet. When you look at the areas they control, they have pushed outward from the border zone with their heartland in the Bekaa, one of their heartlands in the Bekaa Valley. And they pushed east of there, but it's clear they won't fight on the northern front. They're not going to help the Syrian Arab army take back Aleppo or Idlib. They're going to push the Sunni militia away from parts of Lebanon that they happen to care about. And beyond that, the Alawites are on their own. They have Hezbollah advisors and Iranian Hezbollah associated advisors, but they're not going to contribute. But all that makes it very hard to say what is the combat strength, what are the casualties. It's very hard to say. But that your basic question, how come they're not terrified of the Sunni militias, is a really, really good question. And it's in some ways maybe the biggest unanswered question of the Syrian war, because everybody in Western media is terrified of those militias. But the closer you get to the battlefield, the less terrified they are. How come the Israelis aren't terrified of those Sunni militias? Because one thing that's abundantly clear is that they're not. They're terrified of Hezbollah. They're not scared of Islamic State at all. The people who are scared of Islamic State are in like London and Washington. But the Israelis have, as I've said many times, have not attacked Islamic State once. They've attacked the Syrian Arab army, Alawite army, hundreds of times. They've attacked Hezbollah hundreds of times. Nobody is particularly scared of those people. One reason for that, and maybe the bottom line on why Assad isn't scared of them, is that the Islamic State's purpose is not to defeat Assad. And you hear this complaint all the time from other Sunni fighters. They don't fight Assad's army. They don't fight the Alawites. What they are busy doing is carving out the caliphate. Compared to that job, Assad is just a nuisance. And besides, if you really believe, and a lot of these guys really do believe, then once the caliphate is established, Assad will vanish.
So that means they're fighting other Sunnis mostly.
Yeah, other Sunni. There are small Alawite bases in the east around Deir ez-Zor and along a few islands in the Euphrates Valley. But basically, they're fighting for control against other Sunni militias because their real power is in Iraq, and they're just extending power into Syria in order to create a more plausible-looking caliphate. Their job, as they see it, is not to crush these little coastal Alawites at all. And for all those reasons, and also because maybe they're not as formidable as they're made out to be, for all those reasons, you see in this shopping list from the Syrian Arab army and in the pattern of Israeli attacks, all of this, you see much less anxiety about these supposedly fearsome people. And that's partly also because they are fearsome if you happen to be a civilian of a minority group, or even the wrong kind of Sunni, like a Sunni who smokes or a Sunni who laughs in public or, I don't know, wears bright colors or whatever. If you're one of those people, then Islamic State is a fearsome thing because they're sadistic bastards and they'll do horrible things to you. That doesn't make them militarily powerful. I think that's part of the confusion about Islamic State. Like, if somebody tortures people on video, it must mean they're great soldiers. Not at all. Not at all. It's a whole different thing.
But you can almost kind of see this. It's such a strange game that even, you know, America and the West are playing about ISIS, because on the one hand, they build it up as the most horrible, dangerous, you know, fascist, menace, like 10 times worse than Al-Qaeda and so on and so forth. And in which case you would say, okay, well then why would you care if Russia were to come in and yes. help you destroy? Because Russia actually obviously has a vested interest. I mean, both yes. we and Russia have an interest also in trying to make life difficult for each other. But Russia has a very serious interest in undermining ISIL and al-Nusra, because there are, I don't know, a couple thousand at least Russians from the yeah. from the Muslim republics that are that kind of got pushed out in the counterterrorism operations. And they're there fighting, learning how to fight, learning all kinds of skills, and they know they're going to come back to Russia yeah. And cause more damage there and stuff. So why wouldn't, yeah. if they were really that scary, why wouldn't we say, okay, we'll make a, you know, a temporary deal with the Russians, get rid of them, and then we'll get rid of Assad. I mean, Assad, we've never pretended that Assad poses an existential threat to us in any way, as far as I know. We just want him out. But now all yeah. of a sudden when the Russians come in, it's like, no, wait. Assad yep. is dropping barrel bombs and is the most horrible. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's just very confusing. I would think yeah. for the average idiot out there who's waiting for his propaganda to be served up in simple portions, you know, like,
yeah. Well, yeah. that's, yeah, that I've been amazed at the intensity of the propaganda offensive against Russia and the Alawites lately. That Michael Weiss story was just a really crude early version of it. I mean, the Daily Beast has been running stories like that from multiple writers every mm-hmm. day, and you find a very funny pattern in them. You know, like there are all these links in them, but they turn out to be links to other Daily Beast scare stories. So it reminded me of something that Mark Twain said when he read the testimony of the Whitmer family to the Book of Mormon, that, yes, indeed, we, the Whitmer family, neighbors of Joseph E. Smith, saw these very angels. He said, well, there are 8 of them testifying, and I could not be more satisfied if the entire Whitmer family had testified. Because it's all just Daily Beast backing Daily Beast, propaganda from CIA hangers-on backing other CIA hangers-on. Yeah, and why? This just goes back to the fact that there's always been a pattern of truly fearing Hezbollah, I would say. I mean, I don't think anybody's afraid of the Alawites. They're a pretty small, genuinely existentially threatened coastal enclave. But I think a lot of people do fear Hezbollah, especially in Jerusalem and in Washington, D.C., and not to mention Langley. I mean, Hezbollah killed an awful lot of CIA yeah. agents. They kidnapped the station chief of Beirut and tortured him to death, and recorded it, and recorded his screams and his confessions of things that did a huge amount of harm to the agency. They blew up that barracks near mm-hmm. Beirut in 1982 or 3, I forget which, and killed 242 U.S. Marines. It was nobody's fault but Reagan's, but of course nothing was Reagan's fault. So it had to be blamed on Hezbollah. Hezbollah has been really effective against the U.S. and against Israel. And so both those places have a really unforgiving sense of it. And usually it's attributed to their fear of Iran. I'm not so sure about that. The more I think about it, I think it's not the fear that they're Iranian proxies. It's that Hezbollah itself is a formidable thing, and the only formidable Arab organization around, really. And that scares a lot of people.
Yeah, I'll bet the Israelis genuinely fear Iran. I don't know, and not the Syrians. I mean, they were crowing about how in 1982 they... What happened, you know, they had these dogfights and shot down the entire Syrian Air yeah. Force, losing like one drone yeah. plane or something. They love that story. But yep. yeah, the
82 to nothing. They shot down 82 yeah. planes, lost no manned aircraft. Yep.
And, you know, that when I was there, they talked about, I think it was the 73 war, the Syrians could have just walked down from the Golan Heights right into the Galilee Valley. And they thought it was a trick. Apparently they couldn't believe it and waited. So yeah, I don't think it's the Syrians and the Alawites themselves. It's definitely Hezbollah and the Iranians. I mean, there's that theory that goes back a long ways in I think in a lot of American military thinking that if you have a problem with a smaller army, it's always really the fault of the brain bug army or some bigger state, you know? Because otherwise you kind of have to recognize all the kinds of local shit that you've stirred up yourself. It's just better to say, well, no, it's actually the brain bug's fault. We just need to bomb the brain bug out in Iran.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to read one quote that I got from the foreign minister of Syria that actually I've never seen quoted around the U.S. press, but it makes it very clear why they're buying this sort of stuff. In 2014, Assad's foreign minister, Walid Mualim, said, for now, Obama wants to avoid war with Syria. Because remember, in 2013, the U.S. came very close to bombing Syria, which would give a perfectly reasonable rationale for buying all that air defense stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He said, okay, so for now, Obama wants to avoid war with Syria. But we do not know how Obama will react if the Republicans win the 2014 elections, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we explained bluntly to the Russians. You know, that is, we handed them this shopping list and they said, this is why we want it. Because the Americans are crazy. We can't predict what they do. It depends on how somebody in Kansas votes. And we suspect that they're going to vote for somebody like Louis Gohmert, you know, which they did. And therefore, please send us all this expensive air defense stuff. And it's not just missiles either. I wanted to mention before we get off this that the other Syrian purchases have been airplanes. And that's a huge investment. I mean, a Russian airplane is cheaper than an American one, but it's not that much cheaper.
The Yak and trainers? Are you talking about the Yak trainers?
Yeah, they bought the Yak 130, and everybody talks about them. But the Yak 130 is a very light attack craft. You'd think you'd buy Sukhois if you wanted really serious attack planes. The Yak 130 is mainly a trainer. What the Syrians put their money in is two MiGs, the MiG-29 and the MiG-31. And that's extraordinary. That is bizarre if you think about the war in the way most people do. The MiG-31 in particular is a pure interceptor. It's the descendant of the MiG-25, which, you know, the one that Clint Eastwood stole in that movie. I forget. The one that used to scare everybody until they realized it was just like a, you know, a 1970s muscle car with no electronics. Because it was faster than anything else. It is designed to zoom up from the ground like a rocket and bring down high-altitude enemy planes. That's all it's designed to do. It is useless in ground attack. And they bought at least six MiG-31s last month in August. They've also bought the MiG-29, which is basically an air superiority fighter, you know, corny NATO nickname Fulcrum. They've probably got at least 50 of them, which is a huge investment. And those can be used for air-to-surface warfare, but not very effectively, not compared to the big Sukhois. And that's just such a strange investment. It suggests that the Alawites think that with Hezbollah help, they can handle whatever happens on the ground. But what they're terrified of is that first world air force attack. And when you look at it coldly, there's good reason for that, because they can be attacked by three such air forces: Israel in the south, Turkey in the north, and the USAF from just about anywhere or nowhere. So it makes sense for them that what they really fear is those air forces using manned or drone aircraft. And that's where they've been putting their money. And it's fascinating to see how unscared they are. I mean, they're not even fighting Islamic State, to be honest. They're fighting Jaish al-Islam, Jaish al-Fatah, other forces. Islamic State is way over in the east, busy killing other Sunni not really bothering them much at all. Not other Sunni and Kurds, of course.
Who are also Sunni, right? But
Who are also Sunni, and although, you know, one thing I have to say from living in the Middle East is that if you think you've run into religious snobbery listening to Baptist gossip, you haven't heard anything until you hear the gossip among Sunni. It's like, who's a real Sunni and who's not? The piety contests are endless, and the Kurds rank very low in those piety contests. Mm-hmm. The Kurds are suspected of being communists, which in a lot of people's minds means they can be killed with impunity. They're not Sunni enough. I mean, and why is it? Why would they be so ungrateful? After all, they've only been massacred by their fellow Sunni on every opportunity. What would make them so ungrateful? But, you know, religious people have some funny thoughts.
So basically, they're making these purchases to as an insurance policy to make potential. I mean, I guess they're expecting that after ISIS gets bombed a bit, that there's going to be pressure on the Americans, or maybe they even cut a deal in advance or something and said, okay, then, you know, once we do that, we will. Yes, we will. Israel and Saudi Arabia and whoever else is, you know, yammering about it, that will bomb Assad as well. Just one trigger will, you know, they just need one sort of little trigger and they'll do it. And so this would be sort of like insurance, I guess, right? To make it the Americans think twice and not think they can do it with impunity.
Yeah, yeah. And what Israel is doing is killing every delivery before that happens. For the moment, Israel is doing it. The U.S. would probably do it if they thought Assad was getting together a real suite of air defense. But for the moment, it's just like Israeli intelligence is very good. So basically, as each one of these components has arrived, it must be incredibly frustrating if you're, a quartermaster for Assad's army. Like, oh, good, we've got our new shipment of S-300. Phone rings. Okay, they're gone. They just got blown up. Okay, we got our Panzer. Now we can protect what? Oh, the Panzer got blown up? Okay. I think that's basically the way it's been going. So whether they'll ever get an air defense...
Well, that explains then maybe why the Russians have made such a very loud... I mean, they wanted everyone to know that they're now in all these different places. So that... Yeah. So that you'll have to think twice about blowing them up, because it'll mean you'll be blowing up some Russians. I mean, it seems to me they did everything to let everybody know that they were there.
And that's a good point. Yeah, because you're much less likely, if you're an Israeli Air Force commander, to blow up Russians than you are to blow up.
Well, especially allies. Americans would be even less so, but
yeah,
Israelis might be a little more, slightly more.
Yeah. Although Israel and Russia have been getting a little closer recently.
Yeah,
they've strange.
Yeah, they have, and they've always had a strange relationship. You know, they have relationships on levels that I don't think America can ever quite understand, and especially after the massive immigration from Russia, from the Soviet Union into Russia, into Israel. I think they're sort of double and triple games that are a little bit beyond us, that they play with each other. I agree.
Yeah. So I think in the long run, I mean, Russia has been the only, there's all this, behind all this anxiety about Russia coming in is the fact that Russia is coming in after everybody else has come in and basically mess things up.
Right.
And that's a good time to come in. You know, the Kremlin is pretty good at timing lately.
Yep.
They weren't always, but they are now. And basically, every Western Air Force is involved by now. In fact, there was a recent story. France is now bombing Islamic State. The UK is now droning, UK citizens who have joined Islamic State. Everybody has been droning and bombing Islamic State for a long, long time, and it's done nothing. And Assad finally said openly, like, well, you guys have failed. Let's have some Russians in here. Maybe they can do something. So the anxiety about them coming in is basically an admission that we've come in and it hasn't worked. We haven't done anything. So maybe the timing will work. I mean, it's pretty smart, actually. And
it is, when you think about how we game plan things too, you know, like that's not supposed to happen after our game plan has been put into motion at that point. I mean, so that's interesting. So, well, actually, you know, believe it or not, we're heading towards the end of the hour now. I don't know. Is there a way to wrap this up?
I just wanted to give readers some credit because there was some really interesting stuff that listeners said. I'm used to saying readers after years of print stuff. First of all, we talked a couple of programs ago about the influence of Ranger School on the U.S. Army's way of making war. And basically that Ranger School means that you've got war run by jocks who are not particularly thoughtful or adaptable in social situations. But counterinsurgency demands more sleazy social skills. And I said, okay, what would you do instead of Ranger School? And Peter suggested, well, what did the British do? They used the British private school, which was the closest thing to prison that you could do for people who were exempt by class reason from actually going to prison. You know, in British private school was basically, you know, brutality and rape and cold and cliquishness. And in that way, he suggested that it was a really good training to be out on your own with maybe one or two colleagues in the middle of a giant territory trying to keep the...
And hating everybody.
Yeah. You can't hate too much.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the big lessons of British private school. And then another listener, Jed, came up with a more grim Marxist explanation, which is, well, why do you think lunkheads like Colonel Michael Steele end up in charge of missions like the one in Iraq where he killed some old fishermen and alienated a whole province? You think they purposely put people like that in charge if they want the mission to succeed? His theory is, you know, the U.S. Army is a machine for wrecking things. And there is a certain logic to this, that the mission in Iraq was to wreck Iraq. And it certainly did a good job of wrecking Iraq. And if you want to wreck things, lunkheads like Michael Steele are perfect. So what he was saying to me is, who are you to say it failed? Maybe it succeeded brilliantly.
From the point of view of especially people who are there to make money, of course you want to wreck everything.
You know, I actually worked with some of those people in northern Iraq, and the wrecker the better. The lower ranks tended to be surprised and outraged, but I doubt there was a lot of either of those reactions.
You can actually make more money more quickly the more you wreck it.
You know, that's an interesting analog to what I was saying about the F-35. Like when you look at U.S. defense procurement as a business rather than having any connection to actually defending the U.S., then the worse the design is, you know, Chimhuja Chimlucha, the worse the design, the bigger the fixes way down the line. Because that means, you know, something like the F-16 was a really good design. There weren't that many fixes involved in it. But something like the F-35 is a god-awful design. So it will have to be fixed again and again and again. And that those fixes mean billions, often tens of billions of dollars. So, yeah, the worse you make it, the more money there is in it. And, that was true both in terms of strategy for Iraq and in terms of defense procurement.
I'll read one last letter here, unless you have another one, from Loith, I think the name is L-O-H-I-T-H. Warner and Mr. Ames, I don't know why, but Garry Kasparov has written a book titled, I Shit You Not, Winter is Coming, in which he tries, I know it's a favorite of yours, Warner, in which he tries to advance the argument that Obama has irreparably damaged the credibility of the United States internationally because he chickened out on invading Syria, negotiated a deal with Iran, and didn't get into a hot war with Putin over Donetsk. I mean, I can give a quick answer to that. Kasparov's a loon. He's a fascinating guy. Like I once, after one of these other Russia protests with Limonov and stuff, he drove me home from the airport in Sheremetyevo down to the center of town, and you know, we talked like about World War One and Russia's role, all kinds of things. He's just this crazy, brilliant guy, and he's a total loon. He believes that there's a conspiracy to date Jesus's death is 2,000 years ago, whereas he can prove mathematically it was 1,000 years ago, and all history is 1,000 years less. He also wrote an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, and I think in Gulf War One, calling on America to completely nuke Iraq and Hussein. So I mean, wow. So he's just, you know, he's a funny guy. I don't know. What else would you expect from him?
Put it mildly. I don't even want to get into why it's important that Jesus died 1,000 years ago.
I don't know. You know,
I'm sure it's connected to current American politics in some way. I'm way too dense to understand. You know, that cheers me up no end, because when I was a kid, you know how when you're a kid and you're a nerd and you're trying to be smart, part of being a nerd smart kid is you have to be good at chess. And I looked at a chessboard and I instantly wanted to whack the thing across the room.
It's annoying.
And I could never learn how to do it properly. And I thought in my secret self-loathing heart, I'm not even smart. I can't play chess. But,
yeah, but now you can stand up proudly and say, they're the loons! They're the loons!
Yeah, if you're good at chess, you must be a crusader of a loon of some kind. So there, I'm vindicated 50 years late.
Okay.
But there's one last story I wanted to mention. I mean, this is Jeremy Corbyn and the Countess Markowitz.
Mm,
yes. I cannot believe this one. It's incredible.
Okay, we got to keep it quick, but go ahead.
Okay. Jeremy Corbyn announced in a meeting in Brighton, England, that he's considering putting up a monument to the Countess Markowitz, whom he reveres because she was part of the Irish Citizen Army in the 1916 Rising, as opposed to part of the somewhat less socialist groups. A dubious distinction, but a very important one on the British Isles left. The amazing thing is that the Countess Markowitz was Maud Gunn's cousin, and real name Constance Gore Booth, and was in charge of defending St. Stephen's Green in the middle of town. By the end of the day, she had 11 notches on her rifle, each one being a soldier killed. But she was elected to Parliament, and she was the first woman elected to Parliament, even though the point of her being elected to Parliament was not to go and never to show up at Parliament. And there's an extraordinary combination of identity politics confusion going on. On the one hand, she's a woman and she was a parliamentarian, but her parliamentarianism was pure obstructionism. She was a militarist to the core. Her comment after the Rising was, "You could at least have shot me with my friends." The reason they didn't shoot her with her friends is that she was an aristocrat, a very, very big aristocrat for that matter, and B, a lady, that is not just a woman. They would have shot a woman, but she was a lady, which is also the reason she got elected to Parliament. So the confusion is extraordinary, but also the courage of doing this. I mean, I have to say, Jeremy Corbyn is a real radical. Mm-hmm. I didn't believe it, but this dude is a real radical. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, he's interesting. I know. He's taken some very... I mean, he stirred up a lot of shit on foreign policy stuff, on Palestine and you know, war crimes and Ireland. I mean, you don't hear even the British left talking about, you know,
no,
Northern
never,
Ireland ever, almost. Yeah.
Never. And I even accused the British left of that on many occasions, and I have to say it's no longer true.
Yeah.
I mean, Corbyn's crew do talk about it, and they talk about it in a way that offends a lot of people, even on their own side, and that's very impressive. I wish America had a few radicals. I mean,
yeah, I know we don't. I mean, Bernie Sanders is the closest we have, I guess, on the left right now, at least. But you know, maybe we're just a few years behind everyone. I mean, weird things are definitely going on in politics. You see, with the Republicans, there's this like bizarre unraveling going on there. I mean, even by their own standards, it's like the whole thing is unraveling. And you know, Bernie Sanders is such a weak candidate. I mean, no one, if he tried to run as a socialist, even probably in 2008, he wouldn't have even made it in the debates probably. So it's, you know, it's kind of interesting. And I think people are sort of bored and disgusted and with being told what something can't be part of the, I don't know, the debate anymore. So, you know, whether it's Trump talking about mass deporting everyone, every Latino, you know, in the country, 11 million Latinos, I think he said he can mass deport them and it would be comfortable for them on the right side, you know, or Corbyn on the left. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting. We'll see how long this goes on for, but, and who dies in a small plane crash, you know, or of a surprise heart attack or something, but anyways, well, good. Okay. So we've run over time. I hope this worked out. But it was fun and, go back and deal with your Giardia. I feel like I can write a fucking book on Giardia too. So
Once you've been east of wherever, Giardia is a fact of life. I mean, I was telling somebody stateside about it, and they said, "What's Giardia?" And I went, "What?
Yeah,
what's Giardia?"
Yeah, no, I have the 1,000 Giardia stare, whatever you got. I mean, it's I'll never forget it. Yeah. So good luck.
Remember
with that.
What Dave used to say in Moscow, like, you know, I don't get cured too fast of Giardia. It's a good way to lose weight.
That's right. It just makes you so tired, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyways, good luck with it. And thanks again. And thank you for everybody for listening. And thank you to subscribers. And we promise we will get even to our, you know, $100 hero Order of Lenin Subotai fellow subscribers and get you guys to properly, you know, advertise in the next show since you are our top sponsors. Thank you again.
Okay, bye, John. Bye-bye.
Bye.